heard from the prosecution team, and now I invite you to listen to the advisory team's presentation.
Thanks, Kita. Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Doug Smith, supervising engineering geologist in the Water Board South Lake Tahoe office, and I'm part of the Water Board's advisory team, along with my colleagues here, Rich Booth, an engineering geologist also, Kim Niemeyer, legal counsel, and of course, our executive officer, Patty Kuyumjin. So the last time we were at a public forum was May 28th, when we conducted a facilitated workshop. Gita was one of the facilitators, and we had breakout groups. And the important thing about that is we heard some excellent suggestions and input at that workshop. And at the workshop, the community spoke, PG&E representative spoke, prosecution team spoke, other public spoke. It was excellent. And at the conclusion of the workshop, we encouraged all stakeholders to work together in the coming weeks in developing their ideas for consensus text. And lo and behold, the prosecution team and PG&E got together and worked together and submitted something to us on July 8th, which they just went over that text. And that text was significant because it showed that those two parties agreed on roughly half of the issues in the draft order, which left roughly half for us to work on. So what the advisory team did is we looked at the consensus text that was submitted to us. We looked at the written comments that were submitted, and those are all posted on the website. We looked at all the input we received at the May 28th workshop, which was excellent, as I said before. And we worked on those, and we came up with our draft that you see here today. I want to highlight some of the main themes on some of the input that we received, some things that we heard that were common amongst everybody. One, that the order needed to establish certainty, needed to establish accountability, and needed to have consistency. And there was an overwhelming preference towards performance-based requirements in most areas, but there was still a need for some specific requirements. So we took that all into account when we came up with our draft that you see today. Regarding the consensus text that was submitted, the advisory team reviewed it, and we accepted it in its entirety. However, we did make a few small clarifications, which you may have noticed, some red text in there. We're not planning to go over those clarifications because we wanted to focus on the other larger unresolved issues. The main issues that we wanted to address are this. Number one, the cleanup requirements for the lower aquifer. Number two, the plume definition and plume mapping requirements. Number three, replacement water requirements. And number four, we added some things, some statements of facts or findings, and added a summary table of the submittal and performance requirements. So what I wanted to do, since I didn't want to speak the whole time, I'm going to transition over to my colleague, Rich Booth, who's going to go over the changes that we made in the cleanup requirements for the lower aquifer. You can find those on Bates page 1-26 to 1-27. And Sue has that up here, starting right there. And it's the red. You can see. Rich?
Thanks, Doug. I'm Rich Booth. I am a hydrogeologist with the Water Board in the South Lake Tahoe office. I do other chores at that office, but that's pertinent for today, to being a hydrogeologist and a member of the advisory team. So Doug asked me to take a look at the lower aquifer requirements that was in the original order, and we came up with some proposed changes, and as I will remind you, the advisory team changes are in red. Underline is what we've added, and of course strikeout is what we're suggesting to delete. Can you scroll down a little bit more, Sue, to show some of the next page? What has been deleted on some of these strikeouts, the little letter I, and so forth, are actually things that have already been done. Some of these wells that we're remediating, that are to remediate some of the chrome 6 that has reached the lower aquifer, are done, so we're striking those out. And as a reminder for those of you that haven't been following this all that closely, this lower aquifer investigation and remediation has been going on for years. This is not new. Chrome 6 from PG&E's release has made it from the upper aquifer into the lower aquifer. This is kind of towards the western part in the southern plume area. And there's no dispute over that. So therefore, work has been done. There are extraction wells pulling the contaminated water out. The question is, though, at what point does PG&E have to stop? At what point is it clean? In other words, what's a cleanup level for the lower aquifer? If you scroll down a bit more, Sue, I'm sorry to try to get your drink there. Right there. The last strikeout in red, you'll see, is 5. Reach and maintain non-detectable chromium concentrations in the lower aquifer monitoring wells by a certain date. The advisory team struck out the requirement for reach and maintain non-detect because we didn't believe that we could technically support a requirement of non-detect. So if you scroll back up to the upper page, instead we made a somewhat subtle but significant change, and you'll see B, lower aquifer, the first sentence, PG&E shall clean up and abate, and in underline you see that are linked to PG&E's historical discharge or remedial action. So the point is, if PG&E caused that chrome 6 that we see in the lower aquifer, they're being required to clean it up. If in fact there's no natural chrome 6 in the lower aquifer to be determined later, then the cleanup level will be non-detect. That will be considered the background. So the only point we want to make here is we cannot quite say right now that non-detect is in fact background, but we hope to, at a future date, know more precisely what the naturally occurring chrome 6 is in the lower aquifer. It may very well be non-detect. It's just that we don't feel that there's sufficient evidence to support that conclusion right now. If later, and by the way, the USGS study by John Isbicki doesn't directly address the lower aquifer. So we can't use the results from that study directly for this, but we certainly can use best professional judgment to make a determination of what we think it may be or how to follow up on what the natural occurring chrome concentrations may be based on the USGS philosophy. But by getting more data that we consider to be sufficient, we can then make a cleanup level that the Water Board would require, and it may be non-detect, it may be 1 part per million, it may be 2. PG&E, any discharger, under State Board Resolution 9249, has the right to offer an alternative if they believe that the requirement is not technically feasible or not economically feasible. They can say to the Water Board, we have an alternative cleanup level. That can be done. Certainly don't know if that will be done, but I want to offer that to you as the possibility of how these cleanup levels are determined. So that's our stance on this lower aquifer cleanup level. I'll be glad to entertain any questions. Yes?
Lori Camper, for the record.
Get her name for a second.
With the prosecution team. And are you aware that the Water Board has years of PG&E groundwater data in monitoring wells 11C and 14C, which are just are located up gradient of the lower aquifer contamination of which we speak? Those years of data show concentrations, they've always been non-detect.
Yes, I'm aware. And those are certainly valid pieces of information to consider. I would suggest that such determinations and findings, or such determinations would be placed in findings and made more specific to the low aquifer and to be substantiated more than the current Clint and Bateman has. And as a possible comment or possible addition, perhaps that could be added in our
okay.
Proposal
so
before the comment.
When you said you didn't think there was evidence, you're not, there may not be.
I'm sorry, good point. There hasn't been sufficient evidence put into the record. or made in the form that's needed to consider for a cleanup and abatement order. Good point. Thank you for that distinction.
How do you intend with the changes that you proposed here, where you've taken out the dates and the actual number, as it were, in terms of a cleanup goal? How do you intend to evaluate compliance with this statement? How would the Water Board do that?
Because this does not have a date in it, it would be to be determined later. So there's not a compliance date specifically for this, because we feel that a cleanup level needs to be established.
What I'm asking, though, is not a final date. I'm asking, how do you measure progress? What level of effort do you expect? In other words, the other thing I wanted to point out is this particular sentence here about continuing implementing the groundwater remediation that PG&E has offered in a work plan. That statement there requires PG&E to implement their work plan. It establishes a level of effort for PG&E to continue operating their current remediation system extraction methods. And by removing that, my question is, how do you actually measure level of effort? So
yeah, sure.
I know maybe you don't want to have a date, but in terms of just how is the Water Board going to establish whether or not PG&E is complying with the statements that they're cleaning up and abating the chromium concentrations? Is that just one molecule a day, a year?
Right,
in other words, how is the board going to decide whether or not they're in compliance?
And so the prosecution team has established such milestones in these previous plans or accepted that?
Well, what I'm saying is that the plan describes the level of effort. It describes pump rates and which
right.
wells are going to be pumped from, how extraction is going to occur, and it's consistent. This type of language is consistent in our southern plume
right.
on the upper aquifer about establishing a level of effort by basically saying there will be continuous implementation of the plans PG&E has in place or that are set in place in the future
sure.
that are approved by the Water Board as time goes on. But that this particular paragraph
okay.
established that.
Okay, that's a good point. We would certainly consider leaving it, putting it back in or leaving it in. Did you have something to say, Doug?
Yes. Doug Smith, I wanted to add a couple things. So item I, that first part, the advisory team proposed to take that out because leaving it in doesn't give any flexibility for other things to be done, for changes to be made down the road if chrome in the lower aquifer were found to have gone elsewhere. And right now, PG&E is extracting from at least one well, from EX37, is continuing to do that and contain and clean up the chromium in the, its chromium, as we believe, from the lower aquifer. And so by taking that out, that actually increases the flexibility of the Water Board to require them to do other things if quarterly monitoring reports and semi-annual monitoring reports show otherwise.
How would you? This is my name is Lori Kemper. How would that happen? I'm just wondering how would you envision implementing this portion of the clean water with this new sentence? How would you envision staff would implement?
This is Doug Smith. The way I envision it is the way we treat, we work with lots of our cleanup abatement orders in the rest of our region. So what happens is we give them a performance requirement, clean up your contamination. In this case, clean up, we're requiring PG&E to clean up its discharge of chromium from the lower aquifer, and that is a performance requirement. And then we require a discharger, PG&E, to submit quarterly or semi-annual reports. Monitor the wells, tell us how things are performing. And then we work with them to review the data to see if their actions are appropriate and are appropriately cleaning up their contamination in the lower aquifer. And by taking out a specific report that was a letter that was done last year, this requirement can live for many years down the road.
I just want to also ask you that. Are you aware that the concentrations in the lower aquifer are at 27 parts per billion? And it's been our impression, and based on PG&E's work plan that's referred to in I, that if they implement that plan, they can achieve background concentrations in a relatively short time frame. I think the Water Board staff and the public has been led to believe that that is a small geographic area in the lower aquifer, and the concentrations are in the teens, you know, and that it's something that we expect to be cleaned up quickly and eliminated from the list of tasks PG&E needs to do, and that's something I wanted, I'm not sure that the board was aware of in terms of establishing, again, I'm just trying to get at consistency and accountability and certainty that are the goals that you heard from the previous workshop. So I just wanted to offer that and ask you to think about ways that we might be able to ensure things are accomplished in a short time frame on the order of a few years as opposed to decades.
Rich Booth. Thank you, Laurie. That's a good comment, and I want to emphasize that we're not saying that by striking out the requirement to go to background doesn't mean you will not clean up to background. That's a good point you're making, that if it seems to be feasible to do so, that would be a likely outcome. Also, as Doug mentioned, we may gain flexibility. We still will require a work plan. We still have, as a common thing, a work plan to have a cleanup, and if, in fact, that November 2014 is the most appropriate one, then we will not strike it out and leave it in there. Thank you.
Okay. Other points of clarification? Questions from the audience?
Cool.
Anything more from the next point from the advisory team?
So, Doug Smith again. I'm going to move on to the second item, which is the plume definition and mapping requirements, and those are found on Bates page. They're in two places. One's in the order on Bates page 1-20 and 1-21, and then that's the plume definition requirements. And then the plume mapping requirements are in attachment 8 on Bates page 1-80 and 1-81. So, regarding the plume definition requirements, because there is a significant level of certainty about the southern plume, kind of know where it is, how it's acting, what's happening down there, we wanted to establish requirements that transition from the prescription of installing wells every 1,320 feet and connecting data points every 2,600 feet apart to performance-based requirements that placed accountability on PG&E, that were consistent with the industry professional standards of geology, hydrogeology, and geochemistry. And so one of our primary goals in crafting this language was to gain some certainty and consistency for the Hinckley community. And we did this by requiring PG&E to either use data for monitoring wells that are spaced no further than 1,320 feet apart, which is about a quarter mile, or by submitting a technical justification explaining why data is not needed every 1,320 feet. And in requiring that technical justification, we gave them specific requirements. We wanted PG&E to specifically address factors about the geology, hydrogeology, and geochemistry of that area. And we listed those areas out. If you go down, keep going right there. Up a little bit. So that's on page
1-21.
Thanks. I got so many pages open here. It's confusing myself. I'm sorry. So this is different than all other previous orders, because it requires either a minimum
well spacing for data, or submittal of detailed technical justification with these minimum factors being addressed. And we felt that the 1,320 feet well spacing as an option is consistent with some of the previous orders that have been issued. And this is for the southern plume. Regarding the northern plume, because there is less certainty there, and as you saw, there was consensus text submitted from the parties that they believe that the background concentrations are uncertain at this time. And because there's less certainty there, what we thought was the best way to go was for technical justification using best professional judgment. Let me switch, Sue, if you could switch to 80 and 81. I'm going to go on to the plume mapping requirements, which are in the monitoring and reporting program. Yes. Should be. Map content. Keep going. Yeah, it's mostly on 81. So, the plume mapping requirements has those same minimum factors that must be considered and evaluated in mapping. And for the northern area, we require these factors known as best professional judgment, which in orders in the rest of our region, it's the default standard is best professional judgment using licensed professionals. But in this order, what we've done is we've then specified what those minimum factors are. And we did that to provide some accountability and consistency, and so the community knows what kind of information they expect to receive. So here are the things that are going to be evaluated. Here's the information that's going to come in. And so so when PG&E submits this information, different than other orders, or different than previous orders, we will respond to this. We have to review this. We have to talk to them about this. And, of course, share that with the community. Do you have any questions?
Hello, my name is Lisa Dernbach. I'm a California certified hydrogeologist, and I'm with the South Lake Tahoe Manhattan Water Board office, and the prosecution team is concerned about the changes that were made to Order 4, A4, page 16, 8th page, 121. Is the advisory team aware of the likely future chromium plume maps that will result from the proposed changes in your order?
Yes.
Okay. So, for everyone's understanding, we've provided some visual aids to make it clear to everyone what changes will likely result from the change in requirements in the order. We have two maps put up here that were sent to the Water Board in 2014 from monitoring reports by PG&E. The map on the left was created with the green chromium plume lines following the specific requirements in the recent cleanup and abatement orders. And they consist of a southern plume, and in this case it was one northern plume attached. And they had hot spots. This hot spot had 275 parts per billion chromium. The map on the right is PG&E's interpretive chromium plume map using the same criteria listed in the draft CAO, using geology, heterogeology, and geochemistry. And in PG&E's best professional judgment, you'll notice the northern chromium plume is gone. You'll notice the western finger is gone. the left bunny ear, that we call this the bunny head up here, the western bunny ear is gone, and the bunny nose in the east is gone. And we want to make sure that you understood these would be the type of best professional judgment maps PG&E would likely be submitting if following your proposed changes in the CAO.
Can I take that, please?
Yeah.
Okay. Rich Booth, also certified hydrogeologist. didn't know we needed to say that. Yes, to answer your question, Lisa, absolutely yes. We don't know the exact interpretation that we will receive from the discharger until, of course, they submit it. But such an interpretation is not a shock. But please remember that the discharger submits, and this is the case for all discharges, the Water Board regulates. The discharger or their consultants submit their best professional judgment for what they believe to be their plume or whatever, and it is up to Water Board staff to agree or not with that. So they may submit such a thing, but if we Water Board staff agrees or disagree, then we have that option, we have that obligation, in fact.
So my follow-up question would be, the best professional judgment map by PG&E's consultant, is this in the best interest of the citizens of California, where chromium concentrations in the hundreds are ignored in groundwater, and is that in the people's best interest?
If that chrome 6 is a threat to public health, then it is not, and it would not be accepted as such.
My name is Lori Kemper. I'm with the prosecution team. I understand from your answer, Rich, that the staff would be able to evaluate that information. And I think we're the prosecution team, because we're the likely staff that's going to be implementing this order in the future. We would, when we go back to the goals that Mr. Smith brought out about certainty and consistency, we are asking the board and its advisors to think carefully about these requirements related to monitoring. Because what I heard you say, Rich, is that every quarter PG&E can provide a map that looks like the one on the right. And that is, again, this map was submitted by PG&E as its best professional judgment. So we do believe that the past is a predictor of the future. And if this is the kind of map we got every quarter and we disagreed with it, are you expecting staff to bring those issues up every quarter? And I guess I would ask you to think about whether or not that is how you want staff to spend its time, or another option. Because when I read the language, is that if you're specifying an open-ended requirement as you have in the revision now, that it's allowing other factors of professional judgment and use of the industry standard and PG&E reliance on PG&E's professionals, licensed professionals, to draw the map, I guess from my impression, I would assume that I'm going to go along with that unless there's something really erroneous about that logic, or if I've already made the point that it was, I guess that puts me in an awkward spot. Yeah. So I guess I understand that if at the first time we get this map, we lay out all the reasons why we think it's not accurate. From our professional licensed geologists using industry standards, we could put that in the record. But it is does feel like we are going down a different kind of path, and so I just wanted to make the public and the board aware of that, because we have been using very strict mapping requirements, and that's what's been produced over the years, and that's what the community has grown accustomed to. And if we move away from that, there will be more questions for everyone in the room, I believe.
So. Okay. Rich Booth again. I want to point out that for all other dischargers, when they submit their interpretation, when the Water Board staff, if Water Board staff disagrees, we make that disagreement, frankly, a requirement, then they cannot subsequently continue disobeying or disagreeing. They have to either reach agreement with us, or they have, of course, the option to petition. So once we've had once the Water Board has required certain agreements or disagreements with best professional judgment, the discharge is not allowed to continue with such. They have to have a second party appeal to the board members. They have to disagree with the water board staff in such a way that that issue is resolved. If the change that we anticipate here would in fact require more staff time to in fact answer some of the best professional judgment put forth by the discharger, we don't anticipate that to be continued every single quarter. There should be a resolution once the water board staff has addressed that issue. If it's not resolved in a quarterly report type of a venue, it has to be another venue. It has to be another way. That's what we anticipate. As far as what the community expects, I'm going to have to defer that to others that have had a much better history on this project than I have. I really can't speak to that.
Yes.
I don't know whether to... Oh,
can you identify yourself for the record?
Let me just ask first. Is it appropriate for a board member to ask a question?
Yes.
Yes. It is.
So I'm Amy Moore, and I'm a board member. So just to try to clarify this a little more. So if a map was presented to the staff with the interpolated line using PG&E's best professional, and the staff noticed that there were wells outside of that line that were exceeding the 10 MCL by orders of magnitude, what would your expectation be at that point?
Do you have an answer?
Or how would this work at that point?
Doug Smith with the Water Board's advisory team. The way we would work with that, and the way I would expect staff to handle that, would be to open up a dialogue with PG&E and ask them what is going on. And this is what we do with all the other dischargers. And have that dialogue and say, what's going on? How should we address this? And in other instances, in other cases, I'm not going to use PG&E, but in other cases, the discharger typically would propose, well, I don't think this is ours because of these reasons, or we don't know, so how about we do this sort of investigation to look into it? And that is typically the way we handle things. And then the discharger would typically propose something, and they would submit something, and we would accept that or review it, accept it, and go forth with it. So we like to base our decisions on what to do with sufficient scientific information. And so sometimes that means going out and collecting a lot more data or looking at existing data. And sometimes you can do both. And in certain areas, you may not have to install wells. Sometimes you can do some geophysical things out there, some measurements to see what the aquifer is doing. But a lot of times you need some wells to really understand some of the subsurface conditions and the chemistry. But you can do some interpolations, and that's what we do as professionals, as licensed professionals. We use all of our knowledge and information to draw conclusions. And so that's what we would do, is work directly with the discharger and figuring out what is going on.
Okay. Mr. Pumphrey and then Lisa.
Pete Pumphrey, Lawton Board. Just so I understand, how did the map on the left come into being?
Lisa Durbach, Lahontan Water Board. The map on the left was generated using criteria that was specified in the 2013 cleanup and abatement order, which contained numerous findings that the preponderance of data demonstrated the northern plume was attributed to the PG&E Hinkley compressor station.
And I don't think that's the question
let me try and ask
the question again. Who generated that map? Who prepared that map? And where did the information come from that was used to draw those lines?
All right, so the map came from PG&E's consultant, C.H. Tuam Hill, with licensed professionals, and it was, they have on the maps data from over 500 monitoring wells, and they used the data from those wells to draw the chromium plume lines based on the criteria for plume drawing in the 2013 CAEO.
Thank you.
Well, this is Kim Niemeyer. I would just add that some of that criteria changed over time. So what started off in the CAO was modified in 13267 orders as we asked for lines to be connected. That so I don't think the way that we requested the plume to be drawn in the CAO was as clear as we tried to make it be later, where we asked them connect lines that are 2,600 feet apart, so I think that those things changed a little bit over time outside of the CAO.
No, that's the 2,600 requirement was actually in the CAO.
Okay.
So the only thing changed was, you're right, there was a change. PG&E submitted information, as they're always allowed to do, saying that they did not believe that the monitoring wells on the west side of the Lockhart Fault showing chromium concentrations was attributed to the compressor station release. We evaluated that information and all the other PG&E submitted, and we concurred with that interpretation. So we told PG&E from now on they no longer needed to map chromium plume lines on the west side of the Lockhart Fault. But for the main plume coming from the compressor station and north, which was already established in the 2013 findings for the CAO, that the chromium in the north was part of the release from the compressor station. So if it's going to change in the new CAO, then those findings from the 2013 CAO have got to be refuted somehow. That already says the northern plume is attributed to the compressor station.
Right, and I think that we included some findings to clarify that a little bit.
Because the 2013 CAO findings were not uncertain. They were very certain that when you have 275 and 17 and 42 parts per billion in the north, in the downgraded flow path of the compressor station, there was no uncertainty that it was all part of the original 1950-1960 releases.
I'd like to say a few things.
So hang on a second. Yeah. Did you want to go first?
It's okay, go.
Okay, so Rich and then...
Oh, thanks, Gita.
Okay.
Rich Booth. The findings for interim... For a background chromium level based on the 2007-2008 background study is in fact what we are saying is uncertain, because we have a background study in place now to determine more accurately, if you will, to have more data for a background study. That is why we consider the 2007-2008 background numbers to be interim, or I think there was another word used earlier today. Granted, they are codified in the finding and in an order. We don't dispute that. They're in order, but we're proposing that to be referred to as interim background levels and not used as a definitive and not used as a way to map a specific plume. And back to the question that you had, Amy, about when you do have large numbers, you have orders of magnitude numbers higher, chrome 6, in the northern area, that, again, if the discharger makes the point they're not from their release and they provide whatever evidence they do and waterboard staff disagrees, waterboard staff is obligated to give the reasons they disagree and can therefore have, because we have the obligation to regulate that and require it to be cleaned up and remediated if it is, from the discharger's release. It would probably be a simple matter if you see evidence contrary. I mean, the Water Board staff would make the point and that it is from PG&E's release with frankly, it doesn't have to be a PhD thesis to make that point. There is a level at which it can be simply scientifically defensible, and then the discharge is obligated to do what the Water Board staff has required. We don't intend there to be a much higher level of proof. We just intend there to be a response to the discharger as to why we believe that it should be done, that the remediation should be done.
So, did you want to go next, or shall we go?
You can go. I can. Okay.
Doug
Smith, I wanted to clarify something for the community, because it can I found it very confusing between all these numerous old orders that are still out there and living, and then this new one, and then all the findings that Ms. Dernbach was referring to. This new order is intended to be the single cleanup and abatement order. And it actually replaces all of those old ones. All those ones that Ms. Dernbach was listing, those are going away. So all the findings that are supporting these orders have to be in this order. And so what the advisory team is, we worked on some of those, and we will be explaining some things that we have added to this order. And so the findings in this section have to stand on them on their own. They can't refer to an old order that was since replaced and went away.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Anita. Kimberly Cox, Board Chair. A couple of questions. Am I understanding that the motivation for the advisory team proposing this language is for consistency with other orders and more of the way we present these orders? And then the second question is, will the work that Dr. Izbicki doing help provide greater definition for that northern plume that's delineated on the map on the left and perhaps give some new boundaries to that in the future? So two questions. Thank you.
Take that one.
Yeah,
thanks, Ms. Cox. Doug Smith, yes, the language here is that the advisory team has proposed is consistent with all the other orders in the rest of our region. We did retain, in part, one piece that was not consistent with the rest of the orders, but is consistent with some of the previous orders, and that is the option for the 1,320 foot well spacing arm. And so that gives some certainty as to minimum data points that are out there. And if there isn't a minimum array of well points meeting that spacing requirement, then we are certain to get information, detailed technical information, from PG&E.
It was Becky.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And will the Izbicki study handles help us in the norm?
Okay. Thank you for getting me. Dr. Izbicki's study is intended to establish what the background chromium concentrations are in the upper aquifer. And so we are hopeful that we will get some results by mid-2017, that preliminary report that the parties had talked about, hopefully, then get some information by then. If not, the end date, the final report, just wanted to remind everybody, because it takes a long time to do this right, the final report is due the beginning of February 2019. I know it seems like a long way, but look where we've been and look, you know, where we're going. So, but about midway in 2018, Dr. Izbicki is supposed to report on the estimated background number of Chrome 6. not give the final report. So he is supposed to be providing the Water Board with these bits and pieces of information as per his contract as it goes along, and not just hold off and wait for the grand curtain rise at the end. And then this order does incorporate requirements to adjust these things as his information comes in, if necessary.
So let me see if I can, Amy Horn, board member. Let me see if I can articulate this question. So, how do we get at certainty about where PG&E's home is? So, one piece of it is the results from Dr. Zbicki's study, where he's looking at different isotopes and trying to figure out, and we'll be able to say with some scientific evidence, this is likely the chromium that is resulted from the PG&E activity, or alternatively, other chromium may not be likely to be resulting from. So that's one piece of it. But then drawing lines on a map, so using hydrogeology, geology, statistics, and data points, and interpolating a line is one way to do it. And my assumption is that that approach would encompass that everything that was likely PG&E's responsibility would be within that line, however that was done. Or drawing point from point to point from wellhead to wellhead now, so monitoring well to monitoring well. So we're looking at the surface. What's happening is underneath us. We can't see what's going on. Do we have any certainty about where that plume line is, where the plume actually is relative to those monitoring wells? And it seems to me that if you connect two points between monitoring wells that are showing elevated numbers, the plume might actually be outside that. So drawing a line from well to well isn't necessarily going to tell you where the plume is. So you have the statistical methods and you have this point-to-point method. So
yeah.
Which gives us more certainty.
So, if you'd like to respond, and then I've got Pete waiting for a question.
Yeah. Show the maps.
No.
Okay, you can talk about
that.
Yeah. Okay. Rich Booth, advisor team. Point well made. If I understand you correctly, I think Amy's giving an example where a monitoring well will show a result, and let's say we're going to let. And by the way, we can keep the. We're proposing this order to make these changes. This is a proposal. The board can, of course, accept it or reject it. The monitoring well, let's say it has 3.5 from 6, and all the points west of that well are higher than that. It seems the main part of the plume, the southern plume, let's say, is west of that. Well, does that mean that it's likely that at some point east of that well, the 3.1 line exists? Do we drill a well to find that exact 3.1 line, or do we use reasonable extrapolation to determine where that 3.1 line might be? And industry standard is the latter. We use reasonable extrapolation to determine where that 3.1 line might be based on the hydrogeology of the situation. That's typically what's done. And the requirement to have a specific monitoring well spacing to determine that is typically not done. It's my understanding that such a prescriptive monitoring well spacing and plume drawing was very important in the past for this site. It had consequences other than just an accurate plume map. If those situations don't exist now, then they may be obsolete or they may be not necessary to draw the plume. You still want to have whatever continuity of expectations from the community, but the actual drawing of the plume, we're recommending it be done more with this extrapolation method, more with this interpreted or inferred method, is our recommendation.
I'd like to add something. Doug Smith, so to answer your question directly, Dr. Horn, I believe there's more certainty using the interpretation method, and I'll tell you why, rather than connecting dots. Because the subsurface is something that cannot be seen, we have to rely on geologists, civil engineers, hydrogeologists to poke holes. The subsurface is very diverse, and in the Hinckley area, there's been thousands and thousands of years of sediments laying in from the river over many, many years, building up. We cannot ever see that from the surface. So what geologists have to do is we have to poke holes. We have to look at the lithology. We have to look at the geochemistry. We have to look at the hydrogeology. And we have to make our best professional judgment as to where things are. Where is this gravelly sand that the contamination may be following? Where is this more permeable layer that it may be going in? We have to take all this into account and really use our best professional judgment, our expertise, our knowledge. We go to school for years to understand this, things that we can't see that we have to interpret. And then we can draw lines on maps, dash them where we're not sure, question them where we absolutely don't know, solid where we have great information, and be done with it. Rather than saying, you got to connect it from this well to that one, because that provides a different type of certainty.
Yeah, I still have a question about the two maps. I'm sorry to go backwards here. But do I understand correctly that the basic difference between the two maps is not that the data or the monitoring information that allows you to draw the green lines don't exist in both places? The difference is just in the idea that the judgment on the map on the right is that the top area encompassed by the green line is not the responsibility of PG&E. And I see all these people nodding, so I guess I do understand that correctly. Then my second question is, why would there not simply be value in generating maps, or a map, that showed all of the data points and then allowed for someone to say on the map, note, we do not believe, based on our professional judgment, that this area is the responsibility or is linked, to use the phrase that we heard before, is linked to the discharge. I see a huge tempest here, but I'm not sure the size of the container of the tempest. It doesn't seem to me that there's a distinction without difference here. If you have the information that allows you to draw the two lines, then that's not the same as saying that it disappeared on one of the maps. It's the same as saying there's a concern about whose responsibility is, and that's a separate question. So why could you not get at a reasonable solution to this by dividing the questions and then answering both?
You want me? Go ahead.
Laurie Kemper, I'm with the prosecution team, and I'm just going to jump in because that's an excellent idea, Mr. Pumphrey, and in fact that is what we do right now. So under the current order that PG&E is under, that was a compromise we reached by sitting down with PG&E and talking with them in a negotiation. What happened was there was a period of about a year where PG&E was submitting these two maps to us every quarter. These were submitted as part of a quarterly monitoring report submittal, and they were also being provided to the two newspapers that are present today. And it appeared there was a lot of confusion from the public. And we sat down with PG&E and we said, there's got to be a different way. And so what we agreed to, and this is what PG&E is currently under orders to provide, is the map on the left-hand side with insets where they can highlight areas where they disagree, where they dispute our professional judgment, they're using their professional judgment to say why they feel, believe, or have information to say that the Western finger doesn't belong to them or the North. So they use insets. And we thought it was important that those insets, we didn't provide that map today, but the inset, you know, our place is up in here on the map so that it's when someone goes to our web page, they can see PG&E's description and their judgment on what their professional judgment says about some of the origins of the plumbia in these areas that are under dispute right now. And I would argue that that is something we want to continue until such time the board has enough information to change background numbers or plume mapping. It seems premature to make this kind of change right now because we're going to end up. And I also want the public and the board to know that the public, the wider public, not the folks here, not the people at Hinckley, but the people that call me from the UK, from New York City, from Washington, D.C., they look at these plume maps. They're on our website every quarter, and they are posted. And if all of a sudden, one quarter, they all switch over where it looks like the plume has shrunk dramatically, that's a different story that I don't want to have to continue to explain to people. So that's just where I'd want to... I appreciate you taking the time to hear the consequences because we don't really want to go down those paths of unintended consequences.
Kevin?
Yeah, Kevin Sullivan with PG&E. This is a challenging question, and I want to make sure that we're at least thinking about some of the consequences of these maps. To Lori's point, there are people who look at these maps, and I believe that one of the things as a professional that we have an obligation to do is to try to convey a richness of information so people can make intelligent decisions. My concern here is that when we simply rely on a number that's 3.1, which is a number that isn't certain, that is being reviewed, you know, by the USGS, it presents a very black and white depiction of whether someone is in a perceived plume or out of a perceived plume. There are places in that northern plume where the majority of the data is below 3.1. But any one detection above 3.1 says you're in. So one of the weaknesses with this depiction is that it doesn't convey the fact that you could be a homeowner within that who could have a well that is perfectly below 3.1. It smashes all that data together and sort of paints, if you will, a worse case. And I'd also suggest that to try to if we're not careful to the casual observer from the UK or whatnot, you would get the impression on that map on the left that if we just focus on the line, which is what people are want to do, the data gets stripped out, that somehow a perceived risk in the center of the lower southern plume, where the concentrations are in the hundreds or thousands, that you're in the same boat if you're way up in the north where you might have three wells, one that is at 3.2, one's at 1.0, and one's at 1.5. That would put you in the same plume. So you could literally be in a place where, as we've heard from folks who moved away from Hinckley out of fear, they moved to Victorville and said, oh, now I have four. I was better off there. That's the danger of oversimplifying this and relying solely on this 3.1 line as some sort of black or white up or down vote as to your risk. So that's one of the reasons that as we think about how we're trying to depict this data, I want to just make sure that we're considering the other side of the bigger is not always always better. We want to be technically accurate. We want to tell the best technical story that we can so people can make judgments based on that.
Mr. Pumphrey.
Yeah, I would just make Pete Pumphrey, board member. I would just make one last comment or suggestion, and that is, it seems to me that you can sort of see that were the board to adopt the language proposed at the beginning of the discussion of this item, that it's not going to take very long until you get to the point where you have differing professional judgments And so, since we can contemplate that that's actually going to happen, it's not speculative, because it's already happened in the room, some thought might need to be given to how that's going to be resolved in a timely manner, and how it can go forward without having to be resolved every time one of these maps is due for submission.
Mr. Banks.
Darren Banks, Heat Group. Piggybacking off of what Kevin said, that would be under the presumption that there's areas throughout the country, because according to their data, over the 50 years, it's already talked about. That's under the presumption that Hinkley's Chromium 6 doesn't exist in 3.1. We're here to determine where their Chromium 6 is. Okay? It could be in an area at one part of the day. Okay? And it's their responsibility to clean it up because they allowed it to flow north. So, you know, with him saying this arbitrary number of 3.1, he's correct, because as we see with the USGS study, Hinkley is at the low end for California of having chromium 6. We could be at 0 or as high as 10. So, him, a map showing all the data, because the data continues to flow and move, him talking about wells right next to each other, the depth is why the numbers are different, because the chromium 6 is at different levels. I mean, and in the 4 years or whatever it's been since I've been sitting in meetings, with the exception of Kevin standing up and saying, hey, it's our chromium 6, we spilled it, I've never heard Kim or any of his experts admit to anything. So, of course, that's PG&E's stance. They're not responsible for the dump. They're not responsible for the use. They're not. That's the way it's been for years, decades. So, the board has a responsibility. We currently have a study. We've all agreed to leave things as is until we have concrete, actionable items directed by Dr. Isbell. We all agree to that, including Kevin. So, these big changes are contrary to what he's already agreed to, what the staff's already agreed to, what the community has agreed to, and have to be held accountable for. Because I have Dr. Sanchez here to talk to you, but he's not allowed to create data. He has to tell me what PG&E data is. So the community is we have to depend on you guys doing the right and correct moral thing. I mean, going back to what this is suggesting, what Kevin is suggesting, is going back to the way it was 25 years ago, where there really was, I'm sorry, Lahontan did a poor job. We don't want to do that. We've worked hard to this point. Okay, we have agreements. We have people's words, which are very important to me. So, like I said, I appreciate Kevin's stance, but it's his job to make sure that to either make it as small as he can, because it's about dollars and cents. It's not about right and wrong and where their responsibilities are. It's about keeping PG&E's PR. And we're about people. The community is already completely, it's completely changed. And it will never be back to the way it was 5 years ago. It won't. We won't get our stores back. We won't get our stores back. And at least not the way it was before, because the children are there. So, I just want everybody to consider that. That 3.1 number is right. I've been arguing that it's arbitrary number from the sky, and we proved that through, the looking into it. But to presume that their number doesn't exist below that, that's presumptuous. They're still responsible for that number. And Kevin has stated in front of board members that they can clean it up to 0. Stated it publicly. And that's what our goal is. Clean up all of their responsible chromium sets and byproducts. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Clarification? Other pieces? It's 3:30 right now. We took a break earlier, so we're just going to keep on going. Yeah.
Does anyone need to take a break, or should we? We have one more.
We have two more issues to cover.
Should we take a quick break? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, a quick 5 minute understanding that
10 minutes
because of the issue. So 10 minutes, and then we'll go to the next issue. It's 3:35. I will begin at 3:45.
Like the sound. That's okay.
Yeah. Are you doing okay? As I hear names, I think people, so I'm writing them down. Are there any that you didn't?
Yeah, you don't have to accept somebody.
The only difference is that.
Thank you for coming.
The technical information that we're sending is not required.
Our cow thing went off.
It's more work.
Okay.
That's what we do.
It's that sense of loss, right?
We weren't exactly sure what we were going to get. So. It changes it from the one on the left saying,
This is exactly what you did. Peter suggested.
Yes.
That's why I actually put it up. So I can't map on that.
Yes.
And the consequence of the uncertainty would be that you don't have room as order and cleaner requirements based on your
And there aren't any of those cleanup requirements for this. We took them out. Yeah, we can bring that up. That's actually not a bad point. You can say
I feel like going to grab a snack, but I think we'll be done.
Yeah. The misconception that the map on the right is therefore going to be.
Yeah, I already got my stuff, so.
Let's try this while you.
Yeah, I got it too.
This is a lot.
Argument on the left hand is you don't want to rock the boat, you don't want to disrupt things that we've been doing, and then you change it when it gets to backup stuff.
Well, it's even stronger than that. It's that plus using the existing, although flawed, background stuff.
Yes.
Yep.
And then connecting the dots is consistent.
But the other thing is you have.
And then there's the other argument. You got to correct the ship. And you got to do things right. That's actually more.
It'll be harder.
It's going to be hard.
There will be disagreement. There'll be more work for prosecution staff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, Rich brought it up. Rich had a great. This is kind of what Peter suggested. There's something that we can do to address this. And attachment two, we've done that by saying, okay, keep mapping them.
Keep 3.1. Don't change the map. It's going to freak people out to change the map.
But we also, the advisory team, leave it to the requirements thou shalt please. So we'll just keep mapping it. We've got the protections of the.
Is that in our packet?
That's in the packet, yeah.
Were you going to bring it up to show?
We were thinking about it. It's on.
Put it on the screen.
It's right there.
It's just been out there for a while.
That's what I thought. Yeah, I thought that was great.
Yeah. So that's still, those are still good.
Which I think what we can do is we can go into drive.
We should start with this thing for the run. It's Russian people.
Okay, we can do that.
I mean, it's Russian people. So I just follow the regulations.
You could, there's another idea out there. It's in mapping.
Why is that in the packet?
Why is that in the packet?
Why is that attachment to?
This was part of their proposal of the prosecution team's original draft.
And we went through the order, and all the words where it said Northern Plume, you put the word uncertain in front of the plume. So here's a map that has the word Northern Plume, so we just inserted the word uncertain, just like we did throughout the entire order.
So that came from the prosecution team?
The original did.
The original.
Word,
we added that.
So one of the things that I think is important.
Who made
it the dash marks?
Prosecution team requires it, yeah.
One thing that I thought, though, that is important that is not in here. We do need some sort of mechanism so that there are identifiable online hits, like she was saying, over 275. So how do you identify?
Again, it's not prescriptive to require the discharger to map anywhere you see chrome concentration above a certain number. That's, you do that. You don't need to defend that. That's the requirement. The question is, why is it there? So we could still have the exact same map, put some hotspots, literally bullseyes on the map, and then just explain whether they're there, and have them explain whether they're theirs or not, and if they say it's not theirs, obligating the prosecution team to say why they disbelieve it. Because all they have to do right now is say, no, Virginia, go out and start mediating. So we would require them to explain why they have to disbelieve, why they disbelieve Virginia's recommendation. And I was trying to say, without being too, I didn't want to say too much. We don't have a high bar. We don't have a real high bar that requires somebody to do something. There's just like
a way that we ensure that
I think that see that we don't intend that to be the case.
So we need to distinguish between mapping in the south and mapping in the north. And we can say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we also need to see what comments come in. And I know that seems to be so far the board moves to care about what we're going to decide to do.
Can you check into your answer?
Check with them.
I have not.
Thank you so much.
I think I asked my wife to do it, but if you could do that, that would be awesome.
I don't have any of your plate information.
There you go.
But I'll find somebody.
Sandra Lane just told me his wife got in a car accident yesterday. She's okay, but she's just rattled from the car accident.
Where was that?
Highway 88, you know, by, we know the Martinsville turnoff is 88. Don's wife got an accident, didn't she? She's okay. She traveled yesterday.
My car.
Oh, no. Not your beautiful little one that I love.
No, not the little
hot. You're waiting just to explain it yourself. This is new.
He didn't gas for me. He back right into one of those.
Well, I bet you're grinning.
Yeah, it was amazing. New cars, all the plastic. It's amazing.
You did that for good.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. How recent is that quarter? Is that most recent